We look at the future of arbitration on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new federal law ends forced arbitration in sexual assault and harassment cases. Here's President Biden at a White House signing ceremony in March, calling it a momentous day for justice and fairness in the workplace.
There will be cases where victims want their claims resolved in private, but some survivors will want their day in court. And that should be their choice and nobody else's choice.
Courtesy PBS NewsHour. Join in on all aspects of arbitration. Perspective from employees, employers, 800-642-1234. Dan Ortiz is a law professor, directs the Supreme Court Litigation Clinic at the University of Virginia. Dan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. And Alex Colvin is here, a professor of conflict resolution and dean of the Cornell University Industrial and Labor Relations School. Alex, welcome to you.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Alex, let's start with you. We heard President Biden there in his remarks before signing the Ending Forced Arbitration of Sexual Assault and Harassment Act into law. How significantly does this law curb the use of mandatory arbitration by employers?
It does significantly curb the use in the area that it's focused on, the sexual harassment and sexual assault area. It really is the first major ban on forced arbitration, but it is confined to this particular category of claims. So it wouldn't apply to racial harassment or wage and hour claims or even something like equal pay claims. So it's very focused in sexual harassment and sexual assault, but it is a big deal there in terms of preventing forced arbitration.
Okay, so very focused, but an opening. Dan, what do you find notable about this new federal law? You know, what implications does this have for dispute resolution?
Well, as Alex mentioned, it is limited, but it covers an important piece of the territory. But this is the first reversal, I think, in probably about 30 or 40 years in the law. The Supreme Court has moved the law forward and forward and forward, more pro and pro and pro arbitration. And this, to my mind, Alex may correct me, is the first time legislatively, and I think through real court and Supreme Court interpretation, comes to even there, that there's been some substantial pushback.
And Democrats and Republicans found common ground here, Dan.
Oh, yeah, they did. I think this is a result of the success of the Me Too movement. And of course, it explains how limited the change is in terms of category, category of behavior it covers. As Alec mentioned, it really only covers sexual assault and sexual harassment. And I think it'd be pretty impossible to get bipartisan agreement to go much more broadly than that, at least at this period in time.
Alex, former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson said at Biden's bill signing ceremony that workers got shunted into the secret chamber of arbitration, which really casts arbitration as a very bad thing. But the American Arbitration Association calls it a fair, effective, efficient, and economical method of dispute resolution. How should we view arbitration in conflict resolution methods?
One thing I think that's important to understand is that all arbitration is not the same. There's lots of settings in which arbitration works very well. Classically, in labor management disputes between unions and companies, arbitration's used all the time. It's used in business disputes between companies all the time. However, what's different there is that you have two equal parties jointly agreeing to enter into arbitration. What's different here, and this is what Gretchen Carlson has been trying to highlight, is that the employees are really forced into it. They're presented this take it or leave it. If you want a job, you have to agree to arbitration. And that skews the whole system, I think. That's really where the problem is. So it's not that arbitration per se is bad, but forced arbitration creates a whole series of problems that makes it not work as well as a dispute resolution system.
Can you explain then the difference between voluntary arbitration and forced arbitration? What do you see there to differentiate the two?
Sure. So it starts at the outset. If you think about a union and a company sitting down to negotiate a collective agreement together, they negotiate all kinds of things in their contract. And one of the things they negotiate is an arbitration clause, and they can decide the terms of it. Who's going to be the arbitrators? They'll decide that together. The difference with forced arbitration is what happens is you're walking in for, starting your new job, and we all know the stacks of paperwork that you have to fill out, signing off on this, that, other piece of paper. One of the things will be an arbitration agreement that's entirely drafted by the company. And they'll explain to you, you have a choice, but your choice is either don't have a job or sign the agreement. So there's really not an input from the employee side into it, and really not into deciding things like who's going to be the arbitrator. It could be an American Arbitration Association arbitrator. It could be from some other organization. It could be some individual you've never heard of. You don't get to decide that. So that's really where the difference lies, and that skews the whole system, and that's really where the problem lies.
Talking with Alex Colvin, labor relations professor at Cornell University, and Dan Ortiz here, a law professor at the University of Virginia, as we look closer at arbitration, the process, and what you see. You can join in 800-642-1234. Dan, let's talk about the Epic case in 2018. You arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court on behalf of this technical writer for Epic Systems. Can you explain a little bit about the ramifications of that case and, you know, the writer seeking overtime pay for himself and others at Epic, despite having signed an arbitration agreement?
Yeah, no, he signed, as, you know, Alex described, in the regular course of things, an arbitration agreement. And it also contained what's known as a collective action waiver, which meant that even in arbitration, he could pursue only claims that belonged to him. Mm-hmm. He couldn't actually join up with others who had suffered the same injury and pursue relief together through arbitration. The arbitration business now is effectively a three-legged stool, at least as it affects employees and consumers, where I think a lot of the unhappiness now is. There's the arbitration angle, which Alex has well discussed. There's the collective action waiver bit, which says that you can't pursue arbitration or even litigation collectively. It has to be on an individual basis. And there in the background of all of this, there are non-disclosure agreements, which means that people sign away their right to tell other people what happened to them, that they were the subject of certain kinds of behavior by their employer or even a consumer manufacturer or something like that. And each one of these things poses, you know, problems. But when all three are together, as they were here, it's really quite insidious and hurts the little guy. Now, I can go into Epic in as much detail as you want, but I don't want to get too far in the weeds lest mm-hmm. I lose all your listeners, Kate. But as you said, he didn't actually sign it. He just refused to reply, which meant that he agreed to it. And then he claimed that he and other employees were wrongfully being denied overtime, which is, you know, a common complaint of employees against some employers. And he went to sue. And the Epic then held up the arbitration agreement, which contained the collective action waiver, and said, no, you can't do this. It's got to go to arbitration. You can only go on your own basis. And he said, well, that might be the case in many arbitration contracts, but ones in the labor world are a little bit different because of a federal statute called the National Labor Relations Act, which protects the employee's right to engage in quote unquote concerted activities in pursuit of their mutual aid or protection. And he claimed that collective action was clearly protected by Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, and that made illegal this type of employer arbitration agreement with the collective action waiver. The district court judge, Barbara Crabb in Wisconsin, agreed with him. It went up to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal in Chicago, and they unanimously agreed with him. And then Epic sought review in the Supreme Court, where it ended up. And Epic eventually won the case in a 5-4 vote. whose results, I mean, you can just guess and you'd be right, of the justices who came down on each side of it. And so it was, you know, pitched at the argument as a really big business versus little guy case, which it was. And the little guy eventually lost.
Talking with University of Virginia School of Law Professor Dan Ortiz there, Cornell University Industrial and Labor Relations School Dean Alex Colvin, they stay with us as we look at arbitration clauses when workers have the right to their day in court, whether or not over workplace disputes. Join in on any aspect of arbitration, your experience in the dispute resolution process, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the landscape of arbitration, this out-of-court method for resolving a dispute between a worker and an employer. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new federal law bans arbitration agreements for sexual harassment claims, meaning that survivors can file lawsuits in court against perpetrators. According to the Association for Trial Lawyers, roughly 60 million American workers are subject to forced arbitration clauses. Join in what you signed with your company. Questions about arbitration proceedings, 800-642-1234. We have law professors Alex Colvin at Cornell University, Dan Ortiz at University of Virginia School of Law. They stay with us. So, Alex, you have a spreadsheet of 24 cases over the past 5 years that the American Arbitration Association has administered in Wisconsin. Tell us what you see.
Sure. So one of the things to understand about this forced arbitration is it is a nationwide phenomenon. So we are seeing it in Wisconsin as we are seeing it in states all across America. So this is certainly something that is very Wisconsin relevant, but we're seeing that this nationwide. And what we're seeing is all kinds of different companies that are using forced arbitration. So it's not, you know, one single type of company. Certainly Epic Systems, the one in the case that went to the Supreme Court, coming out of Wisconsin. But looking across, it's everything from, you know, an Uber case to one at Menard, Hallmark, all kinds of companies that are operating across Wisconsin. So we really see the breadth of the impact of forced arbitration.
Do you know how those cases turned out?
So we have some information on how they turn out. So, you know, one thing to kind of know is that most cases in arbitration, like in court, don't go to an actual hearing. They settle before you actually get the final decision of the arbitrator. About 70% of the cases end up settling beforehand. And so we don't see a lot of cases of the ones we've seen from Wisconsin over the last while. We saw four where the consumer employee was successful, and the rest, the other ones were employer or company success. So, you know, a little around 20% of the time, the consumer, the employee is winning. And that tracks with what my sort of research has shown nationally, that the employee is winning maybe one in five cases, which doesn't mean that they always lose, but that's less than we see in court. So in court, we typically see in federal courts, the employees win about 35% of the time, and it gets up to closer to 50% of the time in state court. So we definitely see a lower win rate in forced arbitration, and also typically lower damages too. And those are the things that, you know, we're sort of concerned about in terms of skewing the system against the employee.
Dan, I do want to bring up cost, money. We hear about the economic argument. Is the arbitration process less expensive than taking a case to court?
It surely is. But this is where the difference between individual arbitration and collective arbitration really matters. If you can cheaply arbitrate, but it is still expensive and you can only arbitrate your own claim, you can't aggregate it together with others. Typically, someone in the position of having to decide whether to go after, say, an employer who's not paying overtime, and this, when this is happening to other employees that the employee knows about too, the choice won't be between actually pursuing your claim individually or pursuing it collectively. The choice will be between pursuing it collectively or not pursuing it at all. Because, say, even in arbitration, the expenses, legal expenses included, unless you, just want to go in and represent yourself, can be high enough to discourage the bringing of, perfectly valid claims. Although it is, true in most cases that those costs are less in arbitration than they would be in court. In court, however, there are often, as Alex mentioned, the recovery can be higher, which means you may have more money to pay your lawyer. And in fact, in some kinds of employment cases, if you win in court, you get attorney's fees. So that's a difference too.
Alex, I wonder if you could step back and walk us through what an arbitration process might entail for a dispute, especially in the pandemic era, as so much has gone to Zoom.
That's right. And we have seen a major shift over to Zoom for resolving these disputes. So what it typically involves in a dispute is, you imagine you're an employee who feels they've been treated unfairly at work. They've been fired for some reason. You feel like you were being fired because you were too old, you were sexually harassed on work, you weren't being paid the overtime or minimum wage you're entitled to. So you want to do something about it. The employer, if the employer isn't responsive when you complain, you might go see a lawyer and say, what can I do about this? The lawyer would normally try to go to court with your case. But if it turns out that you've signed an arbitration agreement, you have to go to arbitration. You often find that out after the fact. Most people don't remember that they've signed these arbitration agreements. Mm-hmm. The lawyer discovers it. And then if you want to proceed with a claim, you have to go to arbitration. So you submit a claim through whatever organizations administering arbitration. Then there's a process of picking an arbitrator. They'll send a list from their kind of roster of arbitrators. And, it's one of the sort of, five, six, seven arbitrators on the list. You have to have one of those as the arbitrator. So, you get some ability to influence at that stage, but you're already presented with a list that was designated by the organization administering arbitration, which was picked by the employer. Once you get an arbitrator, then things proceed along with moving towards a hearing. There'll be some preliminary stuff between the two lawyers discussing the case with the arbitrator. And then typically after about a year, maybe you might get to a hearing. Now, that's a little faster than in court. So it is the case that arbitration tends to go faster than court. Typically it takes a couple of years to get a hearing in court, but it takes a year in arbitration typically. So it's still not a super fast procedure. And then eventually, if you do get a hearing, then it's the arbitrator sitting there like a judge, like Judge Judy, essentially hearing your case. And actually, literally, Judge Judy is arbitration. The people going before Judge Judy, they sign arbitration agreements that she gets to decide the case. Though typically they don't wear the robes, right? That's for TV.
Okay.
They dress up like in suits.
Thank you for the color commentary.
You're welcome. And nowadays, during the pandemic, it has often been over Zoom. The arbitrator is hearing your case over Zoom. There's presentation of witnesses, and then the arbitrator makes a decision. And the arbitrator's decision is final. And that's something really important to understand in arbitration. There's no appeal. You can't go to court. You can't appeal to somebody else. The arbitrator makes a decision, and that's it. That's the end of your case.
Dan, what do you make of that lack of appeal ability?
Well, it gives the arbitrator a lot of flexibility, and in some cases, the arbitrator can do rough justice, which may be appropriate in some cases. It also, though, gives the arbitrator some room to disregard the law. I mean, they're supposed to follow the law, but it's very hard to get any kind of relief from an arbitration judgment, short of where the arbitrator, you know, puts in writing, "I'm not following the law, I'm doing this instead," kind of thing, for any, you know, type of legal error that the arbitrator may have committed. As Alex indicated too, it's the employer who chooses the arbitration outfit. So there's going to be some people have argued there's going to be some pressure on the arbitration outfits that are competing against each other. You know, it's not just one, to actually be pro-employer, because that means they'll get more and more business. Mm. And there's also, this is a problem on another level too, because as Alex indicated, people choose the individual arbitrators on the list, and repeat play, those arbitrators want to be employed. Hmm. And so there's going to be some pressure on them to be seen as playing by the rules that the repeat players prefer,
and
we
have to pause right there, and we'll pick it up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the arbitration process on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonprofit American Arbitration Association and the International Center for Dispute Resolution, they seek to advance arbitration and mediation for resolving disputes. And in their annual report published last week, it said it held over 147,000 virtual hearings and mediation sessions last year and acknowledged a backlog of cases in a letter to stakeholders. Join in on arbitration, what you wonder about, how your employer handles disputes, how federal law is changing. 800-642-1234. We have law professors Alex Colvin at Cornell University. Dan Ortiz is here at the University of Virginia. They stay with us. Dan, as you were saying there before the news break, you know, you're picking arbitrators from a list. Arbitrators want to get that repeat business. They want to keep doing their work. Is there some type of conflict there, conflict of interest?
Well, a lot of people think there is, and that the arbitrators will be inclined to favor the repeat players. So, for example, if a corporation initiates, oh, say, you know, 100, 200 arbitrations a year, and an individual employee over that employee's lifetime might initiate one, you wouldn't be surprised if over time a body of pro-employer arbitration policy, you know, developed. That's just the world, way the world works. You know, people respond to economic incentives. You know, I'm not aware of any empirical research that has been done on that, but many people, you know, just worry about it, because it seems sort of intuitive that you would, you know, pay the fiddler.
I think we just, Dan, can you hear us?
Yes, no, I can hear you.
Okay, good. I think you just cut out there. But I want to bring Alex in here, too, about, do you see, you know, I was looking at the numbers of the American Association for Justice and saying that about 240 corporations registered forced arbitration clauses with the American Arbitration Association since the beginning of the pandemic, including the likes of, like, Twitter and Marshalls and TJ Maxx. So I'm just, what do you make of more and more companies adding these clauses or, on the other hand, taking them away?
Yeah, so we definitely have seen an expansion of these clauses over time. You know, my research has found that it really has expanded over the last couple of decades from, you know, about 20 years ago, maybe 15% or so of employers might do this, to now, my most recent study, I found over half of employers were doing this. You know, we estimate that around 2/3 of the Fortune 100 companies are doing this. So really is big, important companies doing it. You know, I think that the reason is fairly straightforward. This provides employers with less risk of employment lawsuits. The chance of losing is lower. The damages are lower. The costs, the defending lawsuits costs employers a lot, this reduces the costs for them. And then there are these structural advantages that they have, as Dan's mentioned, the ability to get out of class actions, and also to keep lawsuits secret and under wraps. If you think about the high profile Me Too cases, companies don't want to come out if there's a sexual harassment case in their workplace. And I think that's a natural motivation. If you set things up this way, there's an incentive for companies to do this.
That's interesting too. And secret and under wraps, can you give us some ideas about where is forced arbitration commonly used? It's not just like you and your employer. I mean, it's like car loans and credit cards. Yeah. And I mean, the list is pretty large.
It's very large. On the consumer side, we see it in all kinds of settings. Your cell phone contract includes a forced arbitration clause. And I can say that because we've looked at all the major cell phone companies, and they all have forced arbitration clauses that include class action waivers. So whichever company you're using, you've agreed to this. Certainly the credit cards are another really common area. Another financial instruments that consumers use, payday loans, student loans, it really is all over the place. When I purchased a engagement ring for my now wife, I actually read through the contract because I'm a bit of a nerd on these things and discovered there was an forced arbitration clause in there. So it's everywhere.
Home building, investment accounts, nursing homes. I mean, it is. It is all over. And I wonder, too, is this also about, keeping things in-house and the reputation that is at stake here of that company versus if you had something in the court system that is very much more of a public forum?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's one of the things that companies are looking to protect themselves. A concrete example of this, there was a Washington Post story about Sterling Jewelers that had a series of sexual harassment cases that were in arbitration for really a decade before the Post reported on this. But they'd all been in arbitration, so people didn't know them about them. And that's a very public consumer-facing business. If stories are out that the place you're buying jewelry for your spouse is a place that's got a history of sexual harassment cases, that's going to be very bad for the company. So it is a natural thing that companies are going to try to keep these things out of the public eye.
Talking with Alex Colvin, labor relations professor at Cornell University. Dan Ortiz is here, law professor at the University of Virginia. You can join in with your experiences and questions about arbitration. 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Kent now in Madison. Hi, Kent.
Hello.
What would you like to bring up?
I guess my experience, I've been a trial lawyer for 50 years. My experience is arbitration is more expensive than going to court because typically in the, say, a AAA arbitration, you pay a fee to start the arbitration, which is much higher than the court filing fee, and you have to pay the arbitrator when you don't pay the judge. So paying the lawyer is about the same in each case, but the arbitration fee and then paying the arbitrator, it makes it more expensive than going to court. Now, I've done that a lot in construction cases and in business cases.
I was going to ask you, what areas have you seen arbitration in play and in your field? How do you feel about arbitration?
I would prefer to go to court because I believe, a lot of times arbitration is not fast, or it's supposed to be, but it doesn't always happen that way. In court, I feel the judge will follow the law. I also have the right to appeal as opposed to arbitration. So I feel more comfortable in court.
Kent, thank you. Dan, Kent, many years of experience there and some of the things that have come up in our conversation here.
Well, yeah, I mean, as Kent says, arbitration is not free. And in certain cases, it can be just as expensive as, litigation. And certainly as a trial lawyer, which he is, would know, the lack of a right to appeal makes a big difference. Just in two different, very different ways. I mean, one, if the arbitrator gets it wrong, there's no way to get it corrected. Whereas you can do that if the trial judge goofs, if you have an appeal. But also ex ante, meaning before the arbitration, if the arbitrator realizes that there's no one backstopping him or her, the arbitrator is going to feel a little bit freer than a trial judge would to wander away from what the law might require.
Alex, In what circumstances are workers better off pursuing a resolution of their dispute through arbitration versus going through the court system?
So there's a couple, I think, of situations. One that we have a lot of experience with is unionized workers, where you've got the union and the company sitting down together. They use arbitration a lot. And part of the reason they do that is both sides, you know, really get to know the arbitrators and trust the arbitrators, you know, who they're jointly picking. So I think that's important. We've got really good arbitrators there. But also, if the arbitrator makes a mistake, they can correct things by renegotiating the deal, the collective agreement. So that works well because of the equality of the parties there. The other setting, I think, after a dispute arises, if a plaintiff attorney and a defense attorney, the attorneys on each side, voluntarily want to agree to arbitration, they could do so. And I think that can work where it's really voluntary. But you can also use other techniques, too. The other one I put on the table is mediation.
Yes.
Mediation, we've got a lot of evidence, works very well, where a mediator helps the parties negotiate a resolution to the dispute. And I think that's, you know, particularly in sexual harassment cases, has proved to be very effective.
What do clauses look like around mediation, or how do workplaces go that direction?
Yeah, so mediation, it's sometimes confused with arbitration because they're both alternative ways of resolving disputes. But what's different about the structure of mediation is the mediator isn't making a decision. It's not forcing any outcome of the parties. The mediator's there to help them negotiate a resolution. So they'll meet and discuss things, but it won't be forced on the employee. It's a more consensual kind of process. It does not look like arbitration in that sense.
Does it close a case, though? I mean, is it?
It can do.
Okay.
Yeah, so it, you're not guaranteed that it will resolve the case. You have to agree to the resolution. But the research that's been done finds that mediation does work in most cases. You get sort of often 80, 90% of cases being resolved in mediation. So it doesn't guarantee a resolution, but a lot of the time it does work.
Here's something else that I was curious about, Dan. You know, when I looked at the American Association for Justice and they put all the top companies that, you know, go toward forced arbitrations, that, you know, one in three employment forced arbitrations was against Family Dollar or its corporate parent Dollar Tree. And Wisconsin's own Menards was fourth on this list of top corporate defendants, you know, in 2020. Why might there be a lot of forced arbitration at some companies versus others?
Well, some companies are better, you know, citizens than others and treat their employees, you know, better. It's not surprising that in industries where there's very high turnover and maybe there's not a lot of expense that a company has to undergo to train someone, they're happy to let people go, that they are might be more inclined to, you know, follow just their own interest in the very bottom line rather than try to treat employees fairly. On the other hand, in industries where it's very costly to replace employees and it's to the benefit of the corporation to have happy employees, they probably are, you know, respect the law, respect the contract much better than other ones and would be less inclined to shave corners.
Dan Ortiz with us on the law faculty at University of Virginia. Alex Colvin is here, professor of conflict resolution at Cornell. Let's hear from mediators, arbitrators, from HR on arbitration and dispute resolution outside of the court system. Still time to talk about this. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on mandatory arbitration clauses, how the law is changing. In arbitration, there is no judge, there is no jury, there is no right to an appeal, as we've been talking about. Another development in this area we're watching, there's a lawsuit regarding racist hiring practices against the NFL brought by former head coach of the Miami Dolphins, Brian Flores, that could be forced into arbitration. Still time for you, 800-642-1234. We have law professors from University of Virginia, Dan Ortiz, Alex Colvin at Cornell University. Stay with us for about 9 more minutes. Alex, you know, looking at the Brian Flores here, hoping other minority coaches would join his class action lawsuit to end systemic racism in NFL hiring practices, does this sound like a case that perhaps should go to court, or would it benefit from arbitration?
Well, this is the type of case which certainly involves a lot of public interest. We've seen a lot of attention to it. The NFL obviously is one of our great national sporting institutions. But, you know, racial discrimination is a great public issue as well. And so I think that's part of the reason that there's been a push to have this type of case go to court, and why Coach Flores has spoken out against forced arbitration in this type of case. You know, I think there is a real public interest here.
Dan, the FAIR Act would end forced arbitration more broadly than the recent law signed by President Biden. What are the chances the FAIR Act passes Congress, and what does the road ahead look like?
In short, nil. It, you know, passed the House of Representatives, which is Democratic controlled, but there's no way that it is going to be able to get 60 votes in the Senate. And, you know, so long as you have you have fewer than 60 votes in the Senate that are going to, you know, favor ending forced arbitration, whether it's, you know, across the board or just in more particular areas, it's really not going to get anywhere.
So what do you watch here as you see this federal law taking effect, and in the, you know, very slim area, I suppose, of sexual assault and harassment, when there are so many more different claims in different areas? But what are you watching for in this area?
Well, I see this as a positive move. It will be interesting to see how much difference it makes in a world where non-disclosure agreements are still upheld in this area. Now, that's, you know, the stuff we've been talking about, the Ending Forced Arbitration, Sexual Assault and Sexual Harassment Act, the Federal Arbitration Act, all that's federal. Mm-hmm. Historically, non-disclosure agreements have been a matter of state law. Ah. And there has been a move among a few states, particularly California, to cut back on non-disclosure agreements, particularly in sexual harassment cases. But, you know, in most states now, by far the majority, they're still enforceable. And so even if you end the mandatory sort of forced arbitration of some of these cases, if non-disclosure agreements still remain in the picture, that's going to make the move less effective than it otherwise would be.
Hmm. Alex, what do you make then of these non-disclosure agreements, and where state law meets federal law here, in what the, you know, federal law has said now on sexual assault and sexual harassment cases?
Well, as Dan says, I think a lot of the action is going to be at the state level here. There's more scope for states, I think, to enact legislation around non-disclosure agreements. You know, I do think it's it has significant saliency. I mean, we saw the sexual harassment area being addressed at the federal level. I think it has similar potency at the state level. And I could imagine what we're seeing in California kind of continuing in other states. I think this is a pretty salient issue with the Me Too movement.
I want to ask you about the American Arbitration Association mentioning in its annual report that it is seeing a backlog of cases, and that there are some people who want a fully live hearing that is not interrupted. And I didn't quite know what the CEO was saying there in their letter, but I'm wondering just what you make of that sentiment of a backlog and how arbitration is handled in the pandemic.
I do think that this is a really difficult issue. You know, as we've seen arbitration expanding, we are seeing more cases, and that's putting pressure on the system. There's only a limited number of arbitrators out there practicing, and there's a lot of variation in terms of the quality of arbitrators. There's kind of a core of experienced arbitrators who do, you know, a lot of the traditional areas of arbitration, but there's only a limited number of them. And as you kind of go down the list, you get into arbitrators with less and less credentials, experience, less trustworthy, and that causes problems. So the backlog, I think, is reflective of a system that's not really designed to handle the, you know, huge number of cases that are being produced by forced arbitration being so widespread now.
That makes me wonder, do arbitrators have a law school background? Do they have a JD, or do they have like an HR background?
So it varies. Most of them have law backgrounds, but it's not required by law. Some of the organizations like the American Arbitration Association have some requirements for some categories of arbitration where people are required to be lawyers, but that isn't required by law. And so different service providers have different rules. Somebody could just hang up their shingle and say, I'm an arbitrator. And that means they're an arbitrator if they get designated by the employer in the forced arbitration agreement. So
wow.
There's no real, there's no sort of credential. Like, it's not like becoming a lawyer or becoming a doctor where there's rules as to what you have to go through in training to become this.
And as we close here, Dan, you know, if I understand, arbitration providers don't reveal the data on the number of cases filed, only on the cases that have been closed. So do we have a full picture of the impact of arbitration in America?
Well, no, we don't. I mean, certainly the arbitration is not as transparent as the judicial process is. You know, the government publishes many figures about how many cases are filed, how many appeals there are, how cases are terminated and all that. And it's not really granular, but you get a good idea of what the big picture is. And arbitration, since it's basically private, can be as opaque as it wants. Now, of course, there's some market incentives for it to be somewhat transparent, but I don't think it will ever be as transparent as the judicial process is.
Won't ever be as transparent. Is there any more further changes ahead in our last moments together that could make it more transparent and more viable?
You go, Alex.
Oh, sure. I was going to say, I think there are pressures on the system in that direction. I think, you know, the Brian Flores case is kind of a good example where, you know, restrictions on sexual harassment, you know, raise the question, why not? Also, if you're looking at things like racial discrimination, I think the kind of more prominent arbitration service providers that have reputations, the American Arbitration Association, JAMS, do feel pressure to have some public accountability. Mm. The problem is the system varies a lot across place to place. And so there's a lot of variation in the actors out there.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Alex Colvin, labor relations professor at Cornell University. Dan Ortiz, law professor at the University of Virginia. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.